Mr. Star Wars, and good afternoon, everyone. Today is the sixth Sabbath in the seven-week count to Pentecost. Next week will be the seventh Sabbath, and then the following day, Sunday, will be Pentecost itself. It was during this count to Pentecost that the Israelites who had left Egypt journeyed from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai. And one of the big events, at least in terms of the amount of scriptures devoted to it, was the giving of the manna. I thought today we would go into this story, what the Bible has to say about this manna in other passages in scripture. So to start with, turn with me to the book of Exodus. And if you go to, we'll start in chapter 14, because that's where the crossing of the Red Sea occurred. And we read about the Egyptians pursuing the Israelites and their reaction, beginning in verse 10 of Exodus 14. When the Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." Well, after crossing the Red Sea and seeing the Egyptians drowned in it, they had a big celebration, a special song for the occasion in chapter 15. And then we read this, beginning with verse 22. "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of the place was called Marah. And the people complained against Moses, saying, 'What shall we drink?' Only 3 days in the triumphal celebration, and they're complaining again." This was probably the first Sabbath in the count to Pentecost, even though such counting had not been described to them yet. Continuing in verse 25, "So he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and when he cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them, and said, 'If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, you veer to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you.' And they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, so they camped there by the waters." And they journeyed from Elim, continuing in chapter 16, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Now the 15th day of the second month that year was probably the fourth Sabbath in the count to Pentecost, so we have no record of the Israelites complaining for about 3 weeks. But that changed now. Verse 3, "The children of Israel said to them, 'Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full, for you brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.' Then God speaks to Moses to let them know what is about to happen. The Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. The people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. It shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily.'" This is apparently only a portion of what God told him, because in the next few verses, Moses clearly knows more about what is going on, what's going to happen. Verse 6, "Then Moses and Aaron said to all the people, children of Israel, 'At evening you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. And what are we that you complain against us? So Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints that you make against me, against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. He said basically the same thing twice, but at least he decided it was strong enough that he wanted to record it twice. Then verse 9, Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your complaints. Now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. What was this cloud? It first appeared soon after they left Egypt. You don't go back to Exodus 13, in the last few verses of that chapter. We read this. So they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham in the edge of the wilderness, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. This cloud was a constant presence. Occasionally it is mentioned again when something remarkable happens. The first time it's mentioned after this event is in the Red Sea crossing that we read briefly about earlier. So Exodus 14, verse 19 says, the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So here we have this pillar of fire equated with the angel of God. Obviously, God's presence was there and in the pillar of cloud and fire. Verse 20, it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. So this interesting pillar of cloud and fire carries on two states. It's a cloud during the day, it's a pillar of fire at night. But in this particular case, it served both purposes. The Egyptians, when they looked, saw a cloud. They saw nothing but darkness. It completely hid their view of the Israelites from them. The Israelites, on their hand, saw a pillar of fire. And it lit up the ground before them. They could see the Red Sea part. They could see the land before them. And they were able to cross the Red Sea in the light of this pillar. Then in verse 21, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. Now at this point, it's obvious that this cloud lifts to let the Egyptians see what happened. In verse 23, the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, that they drove them with difficulty, and the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. So this pillar of cloud was there all along, leading them and giving them light and heat at night, and coolness and shade during the day. But now in Exodus 16, it again apparently changed its appearance. As it said in verse 10, the glory of the Lord appeared in it. And I would guess he was a bit angry. Verse 11, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. And you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. In half a verse, we dispense with the miracle that happened in the evening with the appearance of the quail. A year later, a much more extensive quail miracle occurs, recorded in Numbers 11, but the rest of this chapter deals exclusively with what happened in the morning when the dew lifted. In verse 14, when the layer of dew lifted there on the ground of the wilderness was a small, round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" Which, for those who aren't aware of it, is the word manna. But they did not know what it was, and Moses said to them, "This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat." Now the nature of this unknown substance is not given in detail here. More details are given in other verses. From the passage we just read, we find it was a small, round substance. Here it is said to be as fine as frost. In verse 31, it is said to be like white coriander seed. And in Numbers 11:7, it is like coriander seed in the color of bdellium. So what is coriander? For my research, coriander is another name for cilantro, which some of you might be more familiar with. Sort of like a flat-leafed parsley. But of more importance, what is coriander seed? It is the fruit of the cilantro plant. Indeed, a small, round fruit, similar to, but a bit smaller than peas. Maybe about 2 millimeters or a fifth of an inch in diameter, at the most. It would not have been especially easy. And what is bdellium? Our English word refers to a gum resin, yellowish or even darker in color. But other descriptions say the manna was white. So it probably means something of an off-white color, tending toward a light amber. As for its taste, verse 31 says it tasted like wafers made with honey. Numbers 11:8 says it tasted like pastry made with oil. Sounds tasty, at least for the first few times you eat it. I've referred to the account in Numbers 11, and I will again now. It happened about a year later. And if you turn over to Numbers 11 briefly, keep your finger here because we'll be coming back. I'd like to read a portion of it. Verse 4 of Numbers 11, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up and there is nothing at all except this manna before our eyes.' Now the manna was like coriander seed and its color like the color of bdellium. The people went about and gathered it, ground it on millstones, or beat it in the mortar, cooked it in pans, and made cakes of it. Its taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. When the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna fell on it." Back in Exodus 16, Moses then gives them the first in a series of instructions. 16, verse 16, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent.' And the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need." This is a most interesting passage. They were instructed to gather one omer per person. Some gathered more than they should have, others less. It would be easy to attribute this to greed on the one hand and laziness on the other. Another case of the Israelites disobeying. But in this case, I don't think so. More likely, it was more a matter of ability or lack thereof in gathering this small substance. And when they brought it all together, they redistributed it equitably. And I think that is what Paul meant when he quoted this passage in his letter to the Corinthians. You find this in 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 12. He's discussing in this chapter an offering that he was expecting the Corinthians, which they had promised to make, and he's expecting them to carry through on this. And in verse 12, he says this, "For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have." He's referring here to the idea that if it's your attitude, it's your willingness to offer that is the most important, and that if you do, the amount that you are personally able to contribute isn't as important. If you have a lot, you contribute more. If you don't, you contribute less. Verse 13, "For I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, and that their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack." Which is our quote from Exodus 16. "For all of their faults, their stiff necks, their disobedience, and their complaining, there is one positive trait that shows up time and again among these people, their generosity and willingness to help others." And indeed, that may have been what was happening here. And they helped each other out in collecting the manna. That being said, Moses issued his next instruction in Exodus 16:19. And Moses said, "Let no one leave any of it till morning." Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. But some of them left part of it until morning, did bread worms, and stank. Moses was angry with them. In verse 21, "So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need, and when the sun became hot, it melted." Another miraculous characteristic of this stuff. It could be used as flour in cooking with no problems at all. But left on the ground in the hot sun, it melted. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. On the sixth day, they found a lot more on the ground, and naturally tended to pick it up. And when they measured it out, the leaders came to Moses to find out what was going on. Verse 23, Moses said to them, "This is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." So they laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. And Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none." Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place, let no one go out of his place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called its name manna. Or what's it? What is it? "And it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey." And in verse 32, Moses said, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it, to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness, when I brought you out of the land of Egypt." And Moses said to Aaron, "Take a pot, and put an omer of manna in it, and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations." As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. Now, what was the testimony? We find later on in Exodus 25 that they were instructed to build an ark, into which Moses was told to place the testimony. which we discover still later on, the stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. The Ark is called the Ark of the Covenant 43 times, but it is called the Ark of the Testimony 13 times. When it was created, a pot of manna was stored nearby. And more items were added to this collection as time went on. In Numbers 17:10, we read that Aaron's rod was to be kept there as well. In Deuteronomy 31:26, we find the book of the law was also kept there. This is commented on by Paul, or whoever the author was, of the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews 9, in verse 3, he's describing what the tabernacle was like. And beginning in verse 3, he says, behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all. And so he proceeds to describe what was in there, which had the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. This seems to imply that the manna and rod were also inside the ark, but the original instructions were to keep these items before the testimony. And 1 Kings 8:9 confirms that there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, when the Lord made a covenant with the children of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. So while these items were kept close by, they apparently were not inside the ark itself, except the two tablets. And finally, in verse 35 of Exodus 16, the children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And we read about that event in Joshua 5. You can probably take your finger out of Exodus 16 because we're finished there. And in Joshua 5, they ate of the produce of the land in verse 11, the day after the Passover. Unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten of the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. You don't have to go back there, but chapter 17 of Exodus goes on to describe the next thing the Israelites complained about, more lack of water and the miracle of the water running out of the rock, which we don't have time to get into today. The Bible has much more to say about the lessons of the manna. Deuteronomy 8, beginning in verse 1, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe. Moses has been rehearsing the law of God. The entire book of Deuteronomy is basically one speech that Moses gives them at the end of the 40 years. And he continues that you must be careful to observe these commandments that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. You shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you to hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone. Man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord. This, of course, is what Jesus quoted to Satan when Satan suggested that he could relieve his hunger by turning stones into bread. God sustained the Israelites with manna, but they could only truly live through the word of God. In verse 4, it says, your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Leave it up to you to decide whether wearing the same garments for 40 years was a blessing or a curse. Verse 5, so you should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Let's skip down now to verse 10. When you have eaten and are full, it's been describing what it would be like when they came into the land. It says, when you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, And when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through that great, terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water from you out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. And he may establish his covenant with you, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day, that you shall surely perish as the nations which the Lord destroys before you. So you shall perish because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. Well, unfortunately, this prophecy happened. They did not obey God. They worshipped idols. They were taken into captivity, first Israel, then Judah. Judah was brought back to the land, at least a portion of them. And in the book of Nehemiah, they're at a time when they're worshiping God, and several of the Levites are making prayers and supplications to God. And in verse 9 of Nehemiah 9, they are addressing God and say, you saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt and heard their cry by the Red Sea. You showed signs and wonders against Pharaoh, against all his servants, and against all the people of this land, for you knew that they acted proudly against them, referring to the Egyptians, I think. So you made a name for yourself as it is this day, and you divided the sea before them so that they went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and their persecutors you threw into the deep as a stone into the mighty waters. Moreover, you led them by day with a cloudy pillar, by night with a pillar of fire to give them light on the road which they should travel. Came down also on Mount Sinai and spoke with them from heaven, and gave them just ordinances and true laws and good statutes and commandments, probably on the day of Pentecost itself. Verse 14, you made known to them your holy Sabbath and commanded them precepts, statutes, and laws by the hand of Moses your servant. You gave them bread from heaven for their hunger and brought them water out of the rock for their thirst and told them to go in to possess the land which you had sworn to give them. From heaven, of course, is the manna. Verse 16, but they and our fathers acted proudly, hardened their necks, and did not heed your commandments. They refused to obey, and they were not mindful of your wonders that you did among them. But they hardened their necks, and in their rebellion they appointed a leader to return to their bondage. But you are God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, and did not forsake them. Even when they made a molded calf for themselves and said, this is your God that brought you out of Egypt and worked great provocations, yet in your manifold mercies you did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of the cloud did not depart from them by day to lead them in the road, nor the pillar of fire by night to show them light and the way that they should go. You also gave your good spirit to instruct them and did not withhold your manna from their mouth. Gave them water for their thirst. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness, so that they lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, and their feet did not swell. So in spite of their rebellions in the wilderness, God saw them through for 40 years and did not take away these blessings. In Psalm 78, we get something that's much the same. Psalm 78, verse 13, he divided the sea and caused them to pass through, and he made the waters stand up like a heap. In the daytime also he led them in the with the cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. But they sinned even more against him by rebelling against the Most High in the wilderness, and they tested God in their heart by asking for the food of their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God, and they said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rocks, so that the waters gushed out and the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide meat for his people? And this is a reference to Numbers 11, which we read earlier. And you can see that as we move on through this passage. Therefore the Lord heard this and was furious. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. Yet he had commanded the clouds above and opened the windows of heaven, and had rained down manna on them to eat and given them the bread of heaven. So he'd also already provided them with food. He'd been providing that for over a year. Men ate angels' food. He sent them food to the full. They wanted more. That's why in the following verses it says he caused an east wind to blow in the heavens, and he brought the south wind, and he rained on them quail for a couple of days. So they had enough to eat for an entire month. They got sick of it. The most extensive reference, the most meaningful one for us to the manna, occurs in the book of John. So I'm going to conclude in there. Book of John, chapter 6, verse 26. Jesus had just fed a multitude of 5,000, and returned to Capernaum or that area, and the people had followed him there, and then Jesus looks at them and he says, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. Then they said to him, "What shall we do that we may work the works of God?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him who he sent." Therefore they said to him, "What sign will you perform then, that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, or rather in the desert, as it is written, 'He gave them bread from heaven to eat,'" which is a quote from Psalm 78 that we just read. Verse 32, "Then Jesus said to them, 'Most assuredly I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven.'" Or perhaps we could read that, "Moses did not give you the bread from heaven." But he goes on to say, "My Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And they said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." And Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst." Going down to verse 47, "Most assuredly I say to you, he who believes in me has everlasting life. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever, and the bread that I give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world." The Jews therefore quarreled among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" And Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. As the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so he who feeds on me will live because of me. This is the bread which came down from heaven. Not as your man has ate the manna and are dead. He who eats this bread will live forever." God miraculously provided manna for the children of Israel for 40 years, yet they repeatedly forgot their God and complained and rebelled against him. In our day, God has provided the true bread from heaven. Let us learn the lessons of the Israelites who ate the manna and are dead. Let us obey God and eat of that true bread, Jesus Christ, and live forever.